Last night, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump met for their first presidential debate. They were asked about jobs, the economy, national security, and race relations. Immigration and climate change were not part of the 90-minute debate, which was moderated by NBC's Lester Holt. So what did you think of the questions asked, the answers, the substance, or in far too many cases, the lack of substance? A lot of claims were made about jobs and taxes. So what are the facts? We'll bring a few to the table with our guests. Join us after the news.
Hello, I'm Marion Marshall with the BBC News. Scientists in the United States say the first baby has been born using a new technique that uses DNA from three people. The announcement was made in the New Scientist journal. The method has not been approved in the US, so the New York team engineered the birth in Mexico. Simon Ponsford has the details.
The technique allows parents with rare genetic mutations to have healthy babies. In this case, the boy, who's now 5 months old, has the usual DNA from his Jordanian mother and father, along with a tiny amount of genetic code from a donor. This should allow the baby to be free of a condition called Leigh syndrome, carried by his mother, which affects the brain, muscle and nerves. It caused the deaths of the couple's two previous children. Experts say the new technique, called mitochondrial donation, is revolutionary, but it's also controversial.
The World Health Organization has announced the eradication of measles from the Americas, making them the first regions in the world to be free of the disease. The WHO director, Margaret Chan, described the vaccination effort as an outstanding achievement. Reports from Aleppo say that Syrian government forces have been making advances on the ground in the centre of the divided city. The new offensive was launched with Russian backing after a ceasefire collapsed. Sebastian Usher reports.
2 weeks ago, the hope was that the fighting would stop in Aleppo at least for long enough for urgently needed aid to get through. But that latest attempted truce swiftly fell apart, replaced by a renewed offensive by the Syrian government to win what it believes could be the decisive victory of the war. Heavy airstrikes have hit the rebel-held east of the city for days. Now there are various reports of pro-government forces making progress on several fronts. They appear to have edged deeper towards rebel areas in the old city near the ancient citadel.
The World Health Organization has called for the immediate setting up of evacuation routes from Aleppo for the injured and sick. A spokesman said that there were only 35 doctors left in the rebel-held east of the city to care for 250,000 people. Britain's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson says he wants a jumbo trade deal with the country once the UK has officially quit the European Union. Mark Lowen reports from Ankara.
A few months ago, Boris Johnson led the Brexit campaign, which played on fears of Turkey's EU accession. Turkish membership would, it said, pose security threats and strain Britain's public services. Now, on a trip to Ankara as Foreign Secretary, Mr. Johnson has said the UK will help Turkey to join the EU. And he said he wanted a jumbo trade deal with Turkey post-Brexit.
The head of the American FBI says the investigation into a man accused of bombing targets in New York and New Jersey does not point to a larger terror cell. The FBI director told Congress that the organization would look into prior warnings it had received from the father of Ahmed Khan Rahami. You are listening to the latest world news from the BBC. Mexico's Human Rights Commission has found that a group of soldiers killed six civilians after forcibly removing them from a party 4 years ago. The Mexican army said the six victims were killed as a result of a confrontation. Candice Piat reports.
Mexico's Human Rights Commission said that 20 soldiers had taken two youths and four adults to a field in the southern state of Guerrero and shot them dead. Mexico has relied heavily on the military to fight drug-related violence and organised crime. The US-based campaign group Human Rights Watch says this has led to widespread human rights violations. In the last 10 years, Mexico's Human Rights Commission has received 9,000 complaints of abuse by the army.
The Kenyan government says it's replacing all of its electoral commissioners following violent protests by the opposition demanding their dismissal. The opposition argued the Electoral Commission was biased, corrupt, and not fit to oversee next year's elections. England's football team manager, Sam Allardyce, appears to be in danger of losing his job less than 10 weeks after he was appointed. Video footage appears to show Mr. Allardyce using his position to negotiate a major business deal and offering advice on how to get around rules on player transfers. The chairman of the parliamentary committee responsible for sport, Damien Collins, says the allegations are very serious.
These rules around third-party ownership of players were brought in for a good reason. FIFPro, the World Union of Footballers, they called the practice of third-party ownership akin to modern-day slavery. That's why it was banned by the FA in this country and has been banned by FIFA. So, you know, if true, the idea that the England manager may be prepared to give people advice on how to get around those rules in return for a substantial reward, and that would be an incredibly serious matter.
Mr. Allardyce has yet to respond publicly to the allegations. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump met for their first presidential debate. They were asked about jobs, the economy, national security, and race relations. Immigration and climate change were not part of the 90-minute debate, which was moderated by NBC's Lester Holt. The debate was reported to be one of the most watched in history. On today's Your Call, we are opening the lines to get your take. What did you expect? What did you think? What stood out for you? What are your thoughts about the substance, or in far too many cases, the lack of substance? A lot of claims were made about jobs, taxes, and the economy. So what are the facts? Today, we are joined by Daniel Denver, a reporter with Salon, covering criminal justice, policing, education, inequality, and politics. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And I want to give out the phone number if you'd like to join us. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. There were a lot of expectations last night, Daniel, and a lot of people were wondering, obviously, what was going to happen between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton being on stage for the first time. Overall, what were your assessments? What did you think?
Yeah, well, the anticipation for it seemed more like WrestleMania than a typical presidential debate, but there were a lot of management of expectations beforehand, because how someone performs or is deemed to have performed has a lot to do with what the expectations are leading up to the debate. And so I think the worry from the Clinton camp was that the bar would be so low for Trump that if he just stood up there and didn't make a fool of himself, that he would be deemed presidential-looking and the winner. So the Clinton camp made a point of emphasizing beforehand that he had, in fact, done very well during the Republican debates, you know, and then Donald Trump's camp did the same and tried to lower expectations for its performance. You know, most analyses that I've saw, in my own personal opinion, is that Hillary Clinton did very well, aside from a few few issues, that Trump did not seem like he was in his sort of element, his kind of alpha male element, the way that he was during the Republican debates when he wiped the floor with little Marco Rubio and low energy Jeb Bush. But there's an important caveat here, which that is that if Trump has taught us anything, it's that many pundits don't have a clue what many Americans think. Everyone thought that his campaign was a joke when it was first announced, when he started drawing huge crowds and going up in the polls. Most pundits predicted that it was still impossible that he would win and that he would hit a ceiling and that he would fall. That didn't happen. He won the nomination. At that point, you had a lot of pundits saying, yes, but for very different, we were wrong about that, but for very different reasons, he can't win the presidency. I think some humility would have been in order at that point, and that's now clear that it should have been in order, because the polls have indeed tightened very much. So I thought Trump's performance was a train wreck, but it's still unclear what a lot of Americans think, because people who think it's a train wreck, like myself, have thought he's a train wreck the whole time. But clearly a lot of voters have disagreed with that assessment. So for what it's worth.
That is Daniel Denver, a reporter with Salon. And now I'd like to bring Nancy Eisenberg into the conversation. Nancy is professor of history at Louisiana State University and author of the book White Trash, the 400-year untold history of class in America. Nancy was on recently, and we wanted to get her take. Hi, Nancy. Welcome back. Do we have Nancy? All right, we will connect with Nancy in just a minute. All right, so Daniel, you cover criminal justice issues. So let's dive in and talk about stop and frisk, because that came up last night. Donald Trump says that stop and frisk does not lead to racial profiling. As The Intercept noted when they were live blogging last night, he is wrong. In 2011, at the peak of the practice, the NYPD stopped over 685,000 people, 53% black, 34% Latino. Black and Latino males between the ages of 14 and 24 made up almost 5% of the city's population and 41% of the stops. In almost 100% of the stops, no guns were found. Stop and frisk did not make the city safer, according to many, many studies. So what are your thoughts about that issue?
Yeah, I mean, Trump is sort of an unfortunate blast from the past in so many ways, and stop and frisk is certainly a case in point. I believe it was 2011, also the peak of mass stop and frisk by the NYPD, that the NYPD conducted more stops of young black males than the population of young black males in New York City. So it was a remarkably widespread dragnet practice that a federal judge ruled was unconstitutional. I mean, frankly, unsurprisingly, it was pretty patently unconstitutional. And rather than the sky falling, as conservative law and order types predicted, the end of mass stop and frisk in New York simply coincided with a continued decline in crime in New York. So the end of stop and frisk has not led to more crime. And so what we're seeing from Trump and from a lot of other commentators is over the last few years is a seizing on this idea of there being some sort of Ferguson, the so-called Ferguson effect, which is the theory that protests against police violence have caused police to pull back from doing their jobs, which has then led to a violent crime increase. But many criminologists say, and I've looked into this in a lot of detail, that there's not really hard evidence for this. Yesterday, the FBI released its much-anticipated final national crime data for 2015, and as expected, it showed an uptick in murders for 2015. But very importantly, that violence was focused in a small number of cities, Baltimore, Chicago, and a few others. So we're not seeing a nationwide explosion in violent crime, as Trump has suggested. It's a very sad, very unfortunate, and very important thing that needs to be dealt with in a small number of cities that has to be explained by looking at local context. Their crime overall is still, violent crime and crime in general, is still down way, 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 way down from its early 1990s, from the early 1990s, and even just from just a few years ago. So this is there is not an explosion in violent crime.
Right, and a federal judge ruled against the practice of stop and frisk in 2012. The stops dropped drastically, and so did the crime, as you noted. Overall violent crime in the U.S. increased by nearly 4% last year, the FBI reported Monday, as several major studies are struggling to deal with gun violence. And we can talk about that later in the show. And just quickly, Daniel, what did you think about the fact-checking specifically on stop and frisk? Because Donald Trump made some claims about stop and frisk. I mean, CNN had a debate reality check. A couple other media outlets had specific stories about stop and frisk after the debate last night.
I think that that the media has very much improved its fact-checking operation in recent weeks after the foreign policy forum, when Trump was allowed to state that he had opposed the Iraq war before the invasion, which was false, without being confronted about that falsehood. That said, I would have liked to see Lester Holt jump in on stop and frisk last night. I would have liked to see him jump in when Trump suggested that that immigrants committed more crime, which is demonstrably false. So I do think there's a role for the media to play, and not just, you know, journalists who are allowed to have openly have opinions like myself, but more mainstream journalists. There's a role for them to play when someone says something that is factually untrue. I think the media needs to step in and say, that's false.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, with Lester Holt last night, I was thinking he probably had a massive team working with him, but it would have been easy enough if he had an internet connection to just look up some of these numbers.
Yeah, or as you suggest, he wouldn't have to look it up himself. You know, one of, I'm guessing, a dozen or two dozen producers who were supporting him could have piped that into his earbud.
Right. Well, I mean, we do that every day on the show with a very small team.
I know. I wish I had one of those.
That is Daniel Denver, a reporter with Salon. And hopefully now we have Nancy Eisenberg on the line. Hi, Nancy. Is Nancy there?
Oh, but this isn't Nancy Eisenberg.
Okay. Oh, hi. Is this Nancy calling in to the show today?
Yes.
Hi, Nancy. Go ahead. We'll try to get Nancy Eisenberg on in a minute.
Okay. Sorry. I think your producer, whoever, thought I was her and not me.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we'll try to connect with Nancy.
Okay. I have a couple things to say about Trump and about Hillary. I always watch the facial expressions during these debates, and Trump's facial expressions, somebody should have taken, well, probably somebody did take pictures of him. It was disgusting. I mean, it really was. And Hillary did a little bit too much of what I call the Al Gore syndrome. I mean, she didn't roll her eyes, but she did smirk, and it's not a good thing. The other thing is, and I know people are going to think this is crazy, but she really was dressed completely wrong. I mean, she is trying, or should be trying, to be likable and friendly and accessible. And what she was wearing was terrible. First of all, she looks, red is not her color. Second of all, she looked like she was either a prison warden or something like that. She was all laced up to the neck. She looked very inaccessible. And she should have worn something in a soft blue, mint, lavender, something that really makes her look good. A nice silk blouse. Anyways, but I think that's really important because she did not look friendly at all.
Well, Nancy, thank you for calling. I'm sure a lot of people out there are saying, once again, the woman has to meet these major, major standards that no man has to meet. For those of you who are not watching, Hillary Clinton wore a red suit and Donald Trump wore a blue tie. Well, thank you for calling in, Nancy. And if you'd like to join us to talk about last night's debate, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What about that, Daniel? I mean, this is the first time that we're seeing a woman from a major party debate to become president, and she's held to a completely different standard.
Well, as both a male and someone with absolutely zero fashion sense myself, I'm really in no place to comment on what she chose to wear, nor did I actually notice. But I'm sure many did. Whatever one thinks about Hillary Clinton politically, there's no doubt that she is subject to a certain scrutiny over her presentation and her voice, and as Trump put it, and then weirdly tried to deny 3 seconds later, her look. That said, I think both gender aside and related to gender, because it's inextricably there, she does have a relatability problem, and I don't think many people would venture to argue. I don't think she would venture to argue that she's one of the more charismatic politicians of our time. And for me, that was clear a few times last night when she tried to repeat again and again this kind of canned, pre-prepared line about trumped up and trickle down. Maybe that worked with some viewers watching, but for me it seemed a little too scripted.
Well, and, you know, Nancy is a political junkie. She calls in a lot, and I know she cares about the issues, and I think she said that because she's thinking about people out there who look at these issues, and sadly, they are important to a lot of people, right?
Sure, and as wrong as and unfair as that is, I'm sure that her campaign is, incredibly aware of that.
Right. Well, let's go next to Suzanne in Hillsburg. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I love your show, and I just wanted to comment on that woman that said Hillary looked horrible. I have to disagree with her. If she was a man, this subject would not come up.
That's right.
And she looked, to me, fantastic. And I just feel she didn't need to be muted down. She gets criticized for every little thing that she does, where if she was a man, she would not get criticized for any of these things. The woman can never do anything right as far as her looks are concerned. Who cares what she looks like? It's what she can do for our country.
Well, so getting beyond the looks and the suits, what did you think of the substance of the debate?
Well, she could have done better, but I think she did a great job against him.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in.
Thank you.
All right. So let's get back to the substance.
If you want.
Yes. So, you know, Lester Holt, unfortunately, didn't bring that many facts to the table. I did like his first question because he asked about people who are suffering. And I want to ask you about the jobs and taxes that were brought up. First of all, what did you think about the tax plans that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were talking about? Again, we could have used better fact-checking during the debate. I mean, there was a debate among the media about whether that's the moderator's job or the candidate's job. But can you talk first about jobs and taxes?
Yeah, it's obviously an important issue to most voters, probably at the end of the day, the top issue. And Trump's tax plan, though he has a facade and has an appeal as an economic populist, is in many ways a, and this is not my area of expertise, but a traditional Republican tax plan that gives huge breaks to the super wealthy and a pittance to working class people, but has this appeal as cutting taxes. But when you look at the details, it turns out that the taxes being cut are not for your average American, but for the super rich, and particularly for people like Donald Trump, which I think Clinton did a pretty good job at pointing out. One of Clinton's weaknesses on the economic question, however, was when Trump began to hammer her on free trade and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm-hmm. Trump, and makes me feel weird to say these words, Trump was correct when he said that Clinton had indeed supported the TPP. She did. As Secretary of State, she called it a gold standard. Later on, when she was challenged by Bernie Sanders in the primary, who took her on from the left on economic issues, she changed her tune on that. And we see that consistently with more business-oriented Democrats who tend to run campaigns as critics of trade, but once they're in office, embrace a more business-friendly agenda. And so I think she did have a tough time hitting back on those issues, and I think that you heard during the Democratic primary from a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters that this is precisely why Bernie Sanders would be a better opponent for Donald Trump, because he would really be able to go toe-to-toe with him on this question of economic populism and argue more persuasively that Trump is not a real populist.
Now, let's talk about specifics on the tax plan, because I think this is really important. And it's also so interesting. I read a bunch of articles this morning about, you know, registered Democrats, small business people in different states who said that Donald Trump really spoke to them and they're voting for him because he talked specifics on jobs and the economy. Now, I wish reporters, when they interviewed these people, would say, well, here's his tax plan. How is this going to affect you or help you? They usually don't do that. But the Tax Foundation analysis predicts that under Donald Trump's tax plan, the typical $5 million earner would see his or her tax bill fall by about $800,000 a year. This is under Trump. The plan would increase the debt by almost $6 trillion over the next decade and would cost about 3.5 million jobs.
Well, I mean, I think specifically when it comes to Trump's tax plan and more generally when it comes to Trump's appeal, you see people who live in very different economic with very different economic conditions than Trump, identifying Trump's economic interests and the interests of the rich as their own. And that's not something that's new with Trump, unfortunately, in the United States. For a very long time, the Republican Party has only been able to win because it's been able to convince lower-income and middle-class people that their economic interests were aligned with those of the rich. And I think Trump has sort of taken that to its most absurd extreme.
And according to the New York Times, Hillary Clinton would place a 4% tax surcharge on incomes over $5 million, meaning that the very highest earners would have a 44% top marginal rate. She also wants to implement a rule so that those with income over $1 million pay at least 30%, aimed at preventing high earners from paying low overall rates, thanks to the capital gains tax. She would also limit the value of tax deductions and require longer holding periods to get the low long-term capital gains tax rate. And that money would go for social programs, according to the New York Times.
Yeah, I mean, and it seems clear that that, for your average American, would be a much greater benefit than a massive tax cut for wealthy people that would end up reducing government services for average Americans. But that said, I think this is one of Clinton's greatest weaknesses as a candidate, is that she is not a very convincing economic populist. And as superficial and fraudulent as Trump's populism might be, it is convincing to a lot of people. Whereas it's clear that that Hillary Clinton is often most comfortable at fundraisers with very rich donors. She, without seeming to think twice after leaving her position as Secretary of State, went on a tour of Wall Street to receive get paid six figures for private speeches. And so, yeah, clearly her plan is much better for your average American than Trump. But she has I can't think of a greater weakness that she has as a communicator this campaign than her credibility on economic justice matters.
Mm. Well, I guess, and that explains why some of these people who are Democrats and own small businesses say that they felt like Trump spoke to them and she didn't.
Yeah, it's a peculiar the identification of small business owners with big business owners is an important thing to figure out. I'm reading a book right now by a sociologist named Arlie Russell Hochschild called Strangers in Their Own Land, and this is one of the things that she's exploring in southern Louisiana is how small business owners who are threatened by the expansion and move towards monopoly of large businesses, why they make common cause with businesses that would seemingly be their enemies.
Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Greg in Pennsylvania. Hi, Greg.
Oh, Palo Alto.
Sorry. Hi.
Close.
Yeah.
Just a couple of comments. I listened to the debate. I didn't watch it, so I can't speak to the visuals. But, you know, what's clear is that both of these candidates bring so much baggage to this election. It's really remarkable. And what bothers me is that one thing it's already been brought up by your guest, and that is Clinton is clearly, I mean, give Trump at least some credit for this, if you will. He brought up the whole thing with NAFTA and the TTP, and Clinton didn't forcibly indicate, I'm opposed to the TTP, and make it really clear. And what I'm afraid of is that apparently the polls are indicating that this election is getting tighter and tighter, if you can believe the polls. Trump's appeal is not factual. It's emotional. And I'm really concerned about the fact that that appeal does resonate with a certain population in this country.
Yep.
And I'll say this, I, you know, after listening to that last night, although I think Clinton did a better job on the whole, I still think it was pathetic. It turned into a food fight at times, which is ridiculous, and the moderator didn't do a good job on that. But that, you know, there is a distinct possibility that we could end up with Trump as a president, and that really is frightening.
Mm. Daniel, before we go to break, do you believe these polls that say the race is tightening? I mean, we never find out how many people are polled and if they're all people called on landlines or now cell phones, what the age of these people are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have expertise on polling, but it does, and what we learned from the primary, which I think at some point, you know, 538 was giving Trump a close to 0% chance of winning the nomination in its polls plus formulation, that these things can be off. But I think that I don't doubt that the race has tightened, and it's, from what I can see, it's tightened because Hillary Clinton's support is falling, whereas Trump seems to have reached a ceiling. So we're in this bizarre situation of, and kind of sad situation, of a battle between two of the most unpopular politicians in the United States. And I think the tightening polls have made it clear to Hillary Clinton that she has to make the campaign about a lot more than why Donald Trump is a horrible person. Mm.
Daniel Denver is a reporter with Salon covering criminal justice, policing, education, and inequality. Today we are talking about last night's debate. What did you think of it? What did you think of the questions, the substance, the lack of substance? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. This is your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's 866, toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can post a comment or a question at yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. They'll be talking with students on campus at Hofstra University, the site of last night's debates. And what was it like? Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with human rights activists who are in San Francisco for the Freedom Forum. We'll speak with an activist from Syria who helped form an NGO smuggle video out of ISIS-controlled territory. We'll also speak with an Afghan activist who faces death threats from the Taliban for teaching girls computer science. We'll talk about how activists, journalists, and artists around the world are fighting oppression and creating social change by putting their lives on the line. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about last night's debate, and we'd love to hear from you. What were your thoughts on the debate? What about the substance or the lack of substance? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at Your Call Radio. Today we are joined by Daniel Denver, a reporter with Salon covering criminal justice, inequality, and education. And now I would like to welcome Dave Leventhal to the show. Dave is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. He and his team do an excellent job of following the money. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Good to be back with you.
It's great to have you. So, Dave, what was your overall assessment of last night's debate?
Well, I think on points you give the edge to Clinton in the sense that she put Donald Trump on the defensive for a significant portion of the debate. That didn't necessarily seem to be the case very early on when Donald Trump was a little bit more subdued, sticking to issues. He had some good barbs and jabs about trade, but really began to go off the rails for Donald Trump as the debate wore on. He began to cross-talk with Clinton, interrupt her. He went off on some tangents that I don't even think if you are a dedicated Trump supporter, you would think would be beneficial to him, his candidacy, or trying to appeal to a greater number of people than he appeals to already. So although Clinton didn't have any knockout punches, to use the overused trope, you definitely had a Clinton debate strategy that stuck to the issues, talked a lot about policy, and definitely you know, hit Donald Trump in some of the areas where he is vulnerable. One was really undercutting how he was trying to paint Clinton as somebody without stamina. Hillary Clinton went through a litany of things where she said, well, look, I've traveled the world, I've done this, even testified for 11 hours in front of Congress. When you do all that, Donald Trump, you talk to me about stamina. So, hey, two more debates left to go, but, you know, point Clinton, I think, at this point.
And, Dave, before we get to calls, we talked earlier about jobs, taxes, and the economy. And do you think that these two candidates are really speaking to people's issues? I mean, it feels like in some ways Donald Trump is living in somewhat of a time warp, because he often talks about Pennsylvania and Ohio and all of the jobs lost to trade deals, like manufacturing jobs. I mean, these candidates hardly ever talk about the fact that there's poverty all across this country and people really suffering. I mean, I was just reading a new study came out about what's going on in California. This is according to the Census Bureau. One-fifth of Californians are living in poverty. But what we hear about California is the tech boom and the fact that homes are selling for more than $1 million. We just don't hear this talked about sort of at the national level, especially when we're talking about the presidential race.
Well, that's a good point, and this was a debate that was going to focus, at least to some degree, on economic issues and job issues such as that. I think that it was a little bit lacking on both ends of the spectrum. Number one, you brought up the notion of poverty and people who are struggling mightily. You didn't get a really in-depth sense, certainly from Donald Trump, but also to a degree from Hillary Clinton on policy-wise, what they were going to do to turn things around. There was some cursory discussion of it, yes, but really nothing that was in depth or that would inform the public in a major way beyond what most people already know about the candidates. And yet on the other end of it, yes, you did talk about trade and some overarching terms. There was some talk about manufacturing from Donald Trump. Most notably, we didn't get too much in that debate into some of the new cutting-edge businesses that are really creating jobs and go beyond just traditional manufacturing, high-tech manufacturing for sure. So this is not an area of expertise for me, but just as a listener and a watcher of this debate last night, there were definitely a number of issues that are issues that are close to the hearts of many Americans that didn't necessarily get talked about as much as perhaps they would have liked the candidates to talk about those issues.
Right. Well, we've got a few callers who want to talk about jobs and poverty, so let's hear from Susie in San Carlos. Hi, Susie. Welcome to the show. Hello, Susie. Do we not have Susie? All right, let's go to Joni in Walnut Creek. Hi, Joni, are you with us?
Right, because you would have really asked them the hard questions at both parties.
Also, all right, I'm sorry. I think we're having some phone problems here.
Do you hear me? Hello?
No, I don't hear.
Do you hear me?
All right, let's just take a break from the phone calls and go back to our guests. Let's talk also about jobs when we, let's see, underemployment. That's another issue that didn't get attention last night. Daniel, can you talk a little bit about that? Because the new job numbers came out, I think it was last week or the week before, and most of the headlines were about how things are getting better, there are more jobs, poverty rates are not as high as they were. But what about underemployment, which seems to be the new norm? We've got fewer adults working than at any time since the 1970s. A lot of people want more hours. A lot of people don't have benefits, no retirement, for example.
Yeah, I think that's a major concern, is the way that the economy seems to be structurally moving towards a place that just doesn't include as many people, and you see a lot of people who left the workforce during the Great Recession not returning. So the recently announced economic indicators are good news, there are still incredible issues with people who are not able to look for work or have been given up because they're not good enough jobs. And one key thing that historically has helped to make jobs better paying that we didn't hear anything about last night, not once, is labor unions and collective bargaining. I was surprised, given Clinton's reliance on unions to turn out the vote for her, that it didn't get a single mention.
Let's go to a few emails. I think we're having some phone problems. Sorry about that. Julie writes in, we would have liked to hear more about the candidates' plan to combat climate change. That wasn't brought up at all last night. Or what their position was and how they plan to thin out our exploding prison population, for example. We think the politics of personality has taken over our elections and the electorate falls prey to media spin, such as the sexism commentary. Trump speaks to a voting base that has seen the decline of their lives due to neoliberal policies curated by the Clinton administration and codified by the Obama administration. And then they say Hillary was dressed appropriately. She's being endorsed by neocons and dynasty Republicans. Well, Dave Leventhal, she is being supported by neocons and a lot of Republicans.
In some cases, and it's not necessarily because they love Hillary Clinton more so that they dislike Donald Trump and would like to see just about anyone in the White House, even if it is a Democrat, even if it is Hillary Clinton, than Donald Trump. You know, I think going back to some of the comments about, well, we would have loved to hear about this in the debate, we would love to hear about that in the debate. In fairness, there's only 90 minutes and only so much that the debate moderator can get to during the course of the debate. We will have two more, plus a vice presidential debate. So there will be additional time to talk about the whole variety of different issues, but also to go back to the notion of people who are struggling mightily in the economy, people who don't have jobs, people who are underemployed. Mm-hmm. Something that we look at very closely is how this election, too, for both candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, is largely dominated, at least in terms of the funding of their campaign, the fueling of their campaign, by people who are incredibly wealthy. We had a new report that just came out in the past couple of days that showed that Super PAC, the main Super PAC that supports Hillary Clinton, it's an organization that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money to advocate for a candidate, or in the case of Donald Trump, beat him up. Most of the now nine figures that have flown into this pro-Hillary Clinton group are coming from billionaires or multi-millionaires, and this is something that has given Hillary Clinton a major edge up. Donald Trump, the same is true to a large extent in Donald Trump himself, somebody who is he's right there with his billions of dollars and now being supported by the likes of Robert Mercer and Sheldon Adelson and other folks who are billionaires in their own right. So we get this a lot from people asking, well, where do I fit in? And is the system just automatically skewed against me, who is just trying to make ends meet and work my three jobs and put food on the table for kids? And that's what you do hear a lot this election cycle, about money and politics. It's not the sexiest issue in the world all the time, but it's also an issue that affects a lot of other issues, including pocketbook and checkbook type issues that hit home to pretty much every American all across the country.
It might not be the sexiest issue all the time, but I think it certainly has played a key role, not only, as you say, in giving Hillary Clinton a leg up in terms of fundraising, but I think it's also been a major political liability for her, and goes a long way to explaining Bernie Sanders' shocking success in the primary. Mm-hmm. Is the sense that not only Clinton, but just your typical politician from either party is under control of wealthy donors.
Let's talk a little bit about more about the money. So Hillary Clinton so far has raised $530 million. Dave Leventhal, where is most of that money coming from? And also, what percentage is coming from small donors?
Sure. So, you know, right now that $530 million number, which is going up and up and up every single day, that's a combination of both her own campaign, which she commands and controls, and also outside organizations that are largely run by people who are close to Hillary Clinton, friends, colleagues, confidants, and are running sort of a parallel operation under a different set of rules. It's rules that have been largely put in place following the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission decision 6 years ago, the decision that Bernie Sanders liked to talk about all the time. And Hillary Clinton has come out against that decision in a major way, but yet at the same time, in the here and now, she has become really the chief beneficiary of that decision relative to Donald Trump or even some of the other candidates who were running during the primary season. So that money, to answer your question, Rose, is much of it is coming from people who have extreme amounts of wealth. It's everyone from you know, people in Hollywood like Steven Spielberg or Jeffrey Katzenberg, George Soros, Fred Eichner, who together have put up tens and tens of millions of dollars just by themselves at this point, and coupled with labor unions in many cases, but also very rich, wealthy individuals, they make up a real significant portion of the overall funding pool, for better or for worse, for Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump actually has a greater percentage of small dollar donors, people who are giving less than $200 or less, although he has overall much less money and fewer resources than Hillary Clinton does in a major way. It changes every month, but Hillary Clinton roughly has been in the 20 percentage point range for her overall haul for her own campaign for small dollar donors. For Bernie Sanders, it was up in the 60s, even the 70s in some points. So there's been that divide up until the point that Bernie Sanders dropped out of the race that Bernie Sanders was constantly pointing to, saying, hey, I'm being fueled by small-dollar donors. And Donald Trump can make that claim to a large degree that he's also being fueled by smaller-dollar donors, people who don't have a whole lot of money, but there's lots of them that he can cobble together and run his campaign on. The big thing with Donald Trump is he said he was initially going to put a heck of a lot more money of his own money into the campaign, and he ultimately went back from statements that he had made in the past, and although he's given a lot in the $50 million range right now, that falls short of, say, $600 million, which was one prediction back a couple of years ago that he gave if he ever ran for the presidency.
Hmm. And I think a lot of the public sees this as a form of systemic corruption. It might not be a discrete quid pro quo where a particular donation is being given for a particular action, though in the case of Trump's donation to the Attorney General of Florida, that allegedly might be the case. But I think that people are believe that wealthy donors give money to politicians for a reason.
And then,
and the reason is access to one point, if I may add,
right.
And also to the ability to influence the way that a candidate may think on particular issues.
And then, Dave, just quickly on the Trump side, Sheldon Adelson, the very wealthy Republican, is going to give Donald Trump $25 million, and then reports that came out earlier this year said he's going to spend about $45 million overall on 2016 races.
Yeah, we still haven't quite seen it yet. So until those hard numbers start rolling in, we'll wait and see. You've got to take him at his word, I suppose, at this point. But, you know, a year ago, if we were having this conversation, we'd be talking about the Koch brothers all over the place. Well,
right.
The Koch brothers decided that they were not going to support Donald Trump and only focus on Senate races and supporting Republicans on the Senate side. So Donald Trump, he's really been in the hole in a major way in the sense that the biggest fundraising operation that exists in the United States is effectively stood down because the Kochs don't like Donald Trump. So who would have thought that Hillary Clinton, albeit indirectly, was benefiting from the Koch brothers in this race?
She may be benefiting, but Chuck...
bizarre to think.
But Chuck Schumer...
It's going to be curious to see what effect he's even going to have on this race because this money is coming in so late in the game. Early voting is already starting in some areas of the country, and you're going to have many, many more states by early October that are early voting. So whatever this money is going to do, it better do it quickly if it's going to have any benefit for Donald Trump.
Wow. Daniel?
Oh, I just wonder. I mean, it's good news for Hillary Clinton that the Koch brothers have stayed on the sidelines of the presidential race. But I wonder if Chuck Schumer and the and Senate Democrats hoping to retake that chamber
might regret that they're doubling down on legislative races.
That's a very good point.
Daniel Denver is a reporter with Salon, and Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Today we're talking about last night's debate. What did you think? What did you think of the substance or the lack of substance? What about the questions and the answers? It was a 90-minute debate, and unlike Matt Lauer, Lester Holt asked one question about Hillary Clinton's emails. It didn't get that much attention like it did last time around. During the town hall they had. But what were your thoughts? 866-798-8255. Or better yet, why don't you email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Helen writes, as a Bernie supporter, I wanted to share my favorite political sentiment of the season by a neighbor who just took down his Bernie sign. Giant Meteor 2016, let's just get it over with. We could have had Bill Bradley, Howard Dean, Senator Sanders, were it not for the manipulations of the DNC. I'm 63 and have mostly lost my oldest friends over this election. I've maintained that Hillary is the only person on earth who could lose to Trump. Hillary is a Republican. I've never voted for one and won't vote for one now. She says she'll probably vote for Jill Stein. Thanks for the email, Helen. Denise writes, my main concern about the debate was the audience of some 300 Clinton people at a Holiday Inn restaurant in San Francisco. It could be a mindless audience with laughing. You would expect this at a Trump event. The crowd was rowdy, disrespectful, and ignorant. It was so noisy it was hard to follow the debate. Well, if you want to watch it, you can find it online, Denise, along with some of the highlights. And Jennifer writes, I have to be brief, but I kept finding myself thinking, thank you, Bernie, because of all the good points that Hillary made that had the strength to win the debate all came from Bernie's campaign. What I find astounding is they both think the greatest threat to our country is nuclear weapons. What about climate change? Well, thanks, Jennifer. Hopefully, during the next debate, a question about climate change will be raised. And let's go back to callers, and hopefully the lines are fixed. Let's hear from Spencer in San Francisco. Hi, Spencer. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much.
Hi. Thanks.
So I listened to what you guys have talked about, and one of my major concerns with the debate was that they didn't ask any really hard-hitting questions about the police violence that we're seeing so much in the news right now. It seems to be just setting the country on fire. And I was really hoping to get some gritty action out of some questions on that, because it's such an interesting topic, and it so needs attention.
Well, they briefly touched on it. Lester Holt asked about what's happening with race relations. It was a pretty vague question. Hillary Clinton talked about police shootings, and then Donald Trump pivoted and talked about crime, for example, in Chicago. What are your thoughts on that, Daniel, and how the question was asked and how they answered?
Well, I thought the question was framed in a somewhat unfortunate but predictably bad manner, which is this idea of healing the divide, mm-hmm. as if the big conversation, the problem with what's termed race relations in the United States is that black and white people have some misunderstanding and need to get along better. And it would be great if people got along better, but the problem isn't a lack of, clarity between the races. It's racial and economic injustice, and the two are intertwined. And with the criminal justice system, I think there were some good things that we heard from Hillary Clinton. She said we need to divert people from the system to deal with mandatory minimums, which have, she said, put too many people away for too long for doing too little. But I think the problem is that the criminal justice debate is still very limited to this idea of modestly reducing mandatory minimum sentences for people convicted of nonviolent drug crimes. Unfortunately, the reason that we have 2.2 million odd people behind bars in this country is because we punish people far more harshly than almost any other country for almost everything. So if we're going to deal with ending, if we're really going to confront mass incarceration and decide to end it and bring our prison population down to something like that which prevails in most other countries, we're going to have to think really hard about sentencing for a range of offenses, including people who do things that we think are wrong, not just smoking pot, but, let's say, carrying an illegal gun. Mm. And so one thing that a dissonance that I heard in Hillary Clinton's comments and that I hear from a lot of Democrats is this call for a crackdown on on guns without an acknowledgement that certain gun laws, as they are currently enforced, end up incarcerating young black men in mass. I think gun control is definitely necessary, but right now the gun control that we already have involve a lot of federal and state laws that put often young black men in jail, in prison, simply for possessing the very guns that many white people consider to be a cornerstone of their constitutional rights. So that's something that I think needs more discussion.
Mm. Dave, anything to add?
Yeah, well, just again, to the point of not getting to some of the key issues that we can discuss at length here during the debate, I think we all got spoiled by the number of debates during the primaries, in that going back to the primary debates is not necessarily a bad thing. On the Republican side, there were so many that took place, even though there were many candidates, and even on the Democratic side, there were a number of debates, so there was just more time to probe down into some of the deep issues that the candidates are probably, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, that is, probably not going to get to in the form and fashion that they did during the primary season. So anyone who thinks that the issue that they really want to focus on is going to get a significant amount of play and time during any of these debates may come away disappointed, unfortunately.
Mm. All right. Well, thank you for the question, Spencer. We have time for one more call or two more. Let's go to Ellen in Richmond. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Rose. My point is that I haven't seen any discussion of the fact that Trump wants to increase the lowest tax bracket from 10% to 12%, a 20% increase on the poorest people in the country, and yet reduce the tax rate by 8 1/3% on the richest people, in creating an enormous change in money inflow into the tax system and Social Security.
Actually, we did discuss that earlier in the show. The Washington Post and the New York Times, a lot of outlets have been doing good reporting on this. One of the latest Washington Post pieces is called Donald Trump's Tax Plan Now Favors the Ultra Rich Even More. The typical $5 million earner would see his or her tax bill fall by about $800,000 under Trump. The plan would increase the debt by about $6 trillion and cost about 3.5 million jobs. So there's been some good reporting on that. Hillary Clinton brought up some of these facts last night, but Lester Holt didn't bring any of these facts in. So thank you for that call. We have just about a minute left. We're trying to find the dates for the next debate. But Daniel Denver, what are you hoping comes up in the next debate?
Well, I'd certainly like to see global warming come up because, as Bernie Sanders put in the primary, it is the greatest national security threat that we face. Number two, I was surprised that immigration was barely discussed. Both Trump's harsh, racist, anti-immigrant beliefs and Clinton's proposals to legalize the 11 million odd undocumented immigrants in the country. So those are two things that I would hope would be discussed next time.
And what about you, Dave?
I would also say immigration, just because this has been the cornerstone of Donald Trump's campaign, something that if you go to his website, literally 1/4 of all the text on the issue areas of his website, so we've counted up, have been dedicated to either the border wall or immigration, so that is something that seems to loom large and just simply be an overarching issue of his campaign, where there should be a full-throated discussion between the two candidates about.
All right. Well, it's going to take place on October 9th, and for the first time, the networks producing this debate have agreed to take questions voted on through the Internet. Again, that'll be on October 9th. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and Daniel Denver is a reporter with Salon. Dave and Daniel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with human rights activists who are in town for the Freedom Forum. We'll speak with a Syrian activist who helped form an NGO smuggling video out of ISIS-controlled territory, and an Afghan activist who faces death threats from the Taliban for teaching girls computer science. How are artists, journalists, and activists fighting oppression and creating social change? Tweet your questions and comments to @YourCallRadio and join us at 10 with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
This Week in This America.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.